57. Prisoner's Petty Matters. Nezhin went to help Potapov make the cream. His hungry years in German prison camps and Soviet prisons had convinced Potapov that the process of mastication was not something to be ashamed of or treated lightly, but one of the most delectable things in life, and one in which its true meaning is revealed. "I count the hours to dinner, I count the hours to tea, but perhaps the hour of supper is dearer still to me," was a favourite quotation of this outstanding Russian power station engineer, who had devoted his whole life to transformers with a capacity of thousands and thousands and thousands of kilowatts. Potapov was one of those engineers whose hands are as nimble as their brains, so he quickly became an uncommonly good cook. In the Kriegsgefangenenlager, he used to bake an orange cake using nothing but potato peelings, and in the Sharashkas he had specialized in desserts and become an expert. At that moment he was at work over two lockers placed together in the dimly lit passage between his own bed and Priantchikov's. A pleasant twilight was created by the mattresses on the upper bunks, which obstructed the light from the bulbs in the ceiling. Since the room was a semicircle and the beds stood along its radii, the passage was narrow at its entrance and broadened out toward the window. Potapov was also making full use of the enormous windowsill. Its width was 4.5 thicknesses of brick. Tin cans, plastic containers, and basins stood there in close array. Potapov was performing his rite, trying to whip condensed milk, cocoa concentrate, and two eggs. Rubin had slipped some of these gifts to him. He regularly received parcels from home and always shared their contents into something with no name in human speech. He chided Nezhin for meandering around and ordered him to improvise some extra glasses. One was the cap of a thermos bottle, two were small chemical beakers from the labs, and Potapov had moulded two from greaseproof paper. Nezhin suggested converting two shaving mugs into additional glasses and undertook to rinse them conscientiously with hot water. A restful Sunday atmosphere descended on the semicircular room. Men perched on the beds of recumbent friends for a chat. Men read and exchanged casual remarks with neighbours. Yet others lay doing nothing, with their hands behind their heads and their eyes fixed unblinkingly on the white ceiling. Conversations merged in a general hubbub. Zemelia, the vacuum man, was taking his ease. He lay on his upper bunk, wearing only his underpants — it was rather hot up there — stroking his shaggy chest, smiling his invariable benevolent smile, and telling Mishka the Mordvin, 2 yards away by air, the following story.
"If you really want to know, it all began with that half kopeck."
"What half kopeck?"
"In those days, 1926, 1928, you were only a boy. There was a sign over every cash desk saying, 'Ask for your half kopeck change.' There was such a coin, a half kopeck. The girl at the desk handed it over without a word. Anyway, we had the NEP then. It was just like peacetime."
"You mean there wasn't a war?"
"I'm not talking about war, you dope. When I say peacetime, I mean before Soviet power. No, yes. Under the NEP, people in government offices worked 6 hours, not like now. And they managed all right. And if they kept you behind as much as 15 minutes, they paid you overtime. Now, what do you think was the first thing to vanish? The half kopecks. And that's when it all started. And after that, the copper coins vanished. Then in 30, the silver, and there wasn't any small change at all. You could ask till you were blue in the face, you wouldn't get any change. Since then, things have never been right. There was no small change, so they started counting in rubles. Take a beggar. He doesn't ask nicely for a kopeck for the love of Christ anymore. It's more of a demand. 'Citizens, give me a ruble.' When you pick up your pay at the office, the kopecks are shown on the stub, and that's it. If you ask for them, they only laugh. What a cheapskate. But they're the idiots. When you give a man his half kopecks, you're showing respect for him. If they don't change your ruble at 60 kopecks, they're shitting on you. People didn't hold out for their half kopecks, so they lost half their lives."
On the other side, another prisoner, also on a top bunk, looked up from his book and said to his neighbour,
"Absolutely useless, the Tsarist government. Listen to this, Sasha, my friend. A woman revolutionary went on hunger strike for 8 days to make the prison governor apologize to her, and the clown did just that. Try making the big chief at Krasnaya Pressnya apologize. How a lot would have been feeding the stupid woman through a pipe on the third day, and slapping a fresh sentence on her for provocation. Where did you get that from? Gorky.
Dvayetsyosov, who was lying not far away, shot up.
Who's reading Gorky?
He asked in a menacing bass.
I am.
What the hell for? What else is there to read? You'd be better off in the shithouse communing with your soul. World's full of damned readers, damned humanists, dirty bums, the lot of you.
Below them, a debate was in progress on that age-old prison theme. When's the best time to get thrown in? The wording of the question fatalistically assumed that imprisonment was unavoidable. There is a general tendency among prisoners to exaggerate their own numbers. When there were only 12 to 15 million of them, they were convinced that there were 20 or 30 million. Zex felt sure that their rulers and the MVD were almost the only male persons at liberty. When's the best time to go inside means, is it better when you're young or in your declining years? Some, usually younger men, cheerfully argued that it was better early in life. It gave you time to learn what life was all about, what was precious and what was shit, so that at the age of 35 or so, a man with a tenner under his belt could build his life on sound principles. Whereas, they argued, a man who went inside later in life would be tearing his hair because he had not lived as he should, because the life he had led was one long chain of mistakes and it was now too late to put them right. Others, usually older men, on such occasions, no less cheerfully argued that, on the contrary, if a man goes inside later in life, it is very much like retiring on a pension or withdrawing to a monastery, after taking from life all that it has to offer. This all, in the reminiscences of Zex, narrows down to enjoyment of the female body, smart clothes, rich food, and drink. And there isn't much they can do to an old man in a camp. Whereas they can knock the stuffing out of a young man and leave him such a wreck that he'll never want to have a go at a woman again. This was how they argued in the semicircular room that day, and how prisoners always argue, some to console themselves, some rubbing salt in their own wounds. But their arguments and anecdotes were husks that held no kernel of truth. On Sunday evening it turned out that the right time to go inside is any time. But when they got up on Monday morning, it was obvious that there is never a good time. Yet that isn't quite true either. The best time to go inside argument was one of those that do not exasperate the debaters but pacify them, soothe their souls with philosophic melancholy. These debates never ended in explosions. Thomas Hobbes says somewhere that if the truth that the sum of the angles of a triangle is equal to 180 degrees threatened anyone's interests, blood would be shed for it. But Hobbes did not know the convict mentality. The argument in progress on the end bunk by the door was in fact one of those that can lead to blows or bloodshed, although it affected nobody's interests. A turner had come to spend the evening with his friend, an electrician. They began by talking for some reason about Sestroretsk, and then went on to talk about the stoves in houses at Sestroretsk. The turner had spent a winter there, and remembered clearly what the stoves were like. The electrician had never been there himself, but his brother-in-law was a stove installer, a first-class workman, and had built stoves right there in Sestroretsk, and what he used to say about them was just the opposite of what the turner remembered. They began by simply contradicting each other, but the quarrel reached the stage of quivering voices and personal insults, and the noise began to drown out all other conversations in the room. Each man felt humiliated by his inability to prove beyond doubt that he was right. They looked in vain for an arbitrator among those around them, until they suddenly remembered that Spiridon, the yardman, knew about stoves, enough at any rate to tell one of them that the crazy sort of stove he was talking about didn't exist in Sestroretsk, or for that matter anywhere on earth. To the great relief of everybody in the room, they hurried off to find him. But in the heat of the moment they forgot to close the door, and another, no less excruciating argument overflowed from the hallway. Should the beginning of the second half of the 20th century correctly be celebrated on January the 1st, 1950, or January the 1st, 1951? The debate had evidently started some time ago, and was bogged down in arguments about the year in which Christ was born on December the 25th. Somebody slammed the door. The head-splitting noise ceased, and in the sudden silence Khorobrov could be heard talking to the bald-headed designer above him.
"When we begin the first flight to the moon, a meeting will of course be held around the rocket before blast-off. The crew will make a solemn commitment to economize fuel, to exceed the cosmic speed record in flight, not to stop the spaceship for repairs en route, and to pass their landing test on the moon with top marks. One of the three crew members will be the political officer. On the way, he will conduct uninterrupted mass indoctrination work with the pilot and the navigator, explaining the importance of space travel and soliciting comments for the Wall newspaper."
This was overheard by Priantchikov as he darted across the room with towel and soap. A balletic leap brought him to Khorobrov's bed, and he assumed an awesome frown.
"Ilya Terentich," he said, "I can put your mind at rest. It will not be like that."
"How will it be, then?"
Priantchikov put his finger to his lips like someone in a detective film.
"The first to reach the moon will be the Americans."
He burst into ringing, childish laughter and ran off. The engraver was sitting on Sologdin's bed. They were engrossed in a conversation about women. He was 40, and although his face was young, quite grey. This made him very good-looking. He was on top of the world today. True, he had made a mistake that morning. He had scrunched his latest story up into a ball and swallowed it, although, as it turned out, he could have got through the body search with it and passed it to his wife. But to make up for this, she had told him that she had shown his previous stories to a few trusted friends, and they were all thrilled with them. Praise from friends and relations might, of course, be exaggerated and not altogether deserved, but damn it, where could he get a fair assessment? Whether it was done well or badly, the engraver was preserving the truth for all time, the cries of tortured souls, what Stalin had done to millions of Russian POWs. And now he was proud, happy, fulfilled, and determined to go on with his writing. Today's visit had been satisfactory in other ways, too. He had a devoted wife waiting for him, working to obtain his release, and her efforts would soon prove successful. He was seeking an outlet for his elation in the long story he was telling to this unremarkable, though not exactly stupid, man, Sologdin, whose past and future were drab and colourless in comparison to his own. Sologdin was lying stretched out on his back with an open book face down on his chest, bestowing on the speaker an occasional flashing glance. With his little blonde beard, his bright eyes, his high forehead and his regular features, Sologdin was like an old Russian knight, and unnaturally, indecently handsome. He, too, was on top of the world. He heard within himself a sort of triumphant chant celebrating a cosmic victory, his own victory over the whole world, his omnipotence. His release could not be more than a year away, after which a dizzy career perhaps awaited him. Moreover, his body was not aching for a woman as it usually did. It was appeased and purged of its turbid longings. So, seeking an outlet for his elation and for amusement, he let his attention glide lazily along the meanderings of a story that meant nothing to him, a story told by this not at all stupid but perfectly ordinary man, to whom nothing so wonderful could possibly happen. He often listened to people as if patronizing them, trying not to let it show only out of politeness. The engraver began by telling him about his two wives in Russia, then went on to reminisce about Germany and the charms of the German women with whom he had been intimate. He drew a comparison between Russian and German women that was new to Sologdin. He said that having lived with both, he preferred the Germans. Russian women were too sure of themselves, too independent, too demanding in love. They loved with eyes wide open, studying the loved one's failings, discovering that he was not as noble nor as courageous as they could wish. If you loved a Russian woman, you always had the uncomfortable feeling that she was your equal, whereas a German woman was as pliant as a rush in her lover's hands, for he was her god, the greatest and best man on earth. She surrendered herself unreservedly to his tender mercy. She dreamed only of how best to please him, and because of this, the engraver had felt more of a man, felt that he was lord and master with German women. Rubin had rashly gone out into the hallway for a smoke, but not one of his fellow prisoners walked past without an irritating remark. Sick of the pointless argument out there, he crossed the room, hurrying back to his books, but someone on a lower bunk clutched his trouser leg and asked, "Is it true, Lev Grigorievich,
that in China Stooley's letters don't need stamps? If so, would you call that progressive?
Reuben freed himself abruptly and went on his way. But an electrical engineer, hanging down from a top bunk, caught him by the collar of his overalls and began ramming home his last words on a subject they had argued about before.
Lev Grigorievich, we have to adjust the conscience of mankind in such a way that people take pride only in the work of their own hands and feel ashamed to be overseers, managers, or party leaders. We must make it so that a minister conceals his rank just like a sewer man conceals his occupation. The minister's job is no less necessary, but is shameful. If a girl marries a state official, let it be a disgrace to her whole family. That's the sort of socialism I would be content to live under.
Reuben freed his collar, broke through to his bed, lay on his belly, and went back to his dictionaries.